here with me to put in perspective the roller coaster of this week is Katrina Vandenheuvel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine, Amara Jones, economic justice contributor to ColorLines.com, MSNBC's Alex Wagner, host of Now with Alex Wagner, and Matt Welch, editor-in-chief of Reason magazine. Thanks to everybody for being here.
Thank you.
Amara, I want to start with you because we were talking a little bit before the show started that, you know, so I'm saying this is cognitive dissonance. These two things don't go together, but you were saying actually no, this makes perfect sense to you.
It's the one thing that actually ties everything that Romney's done for the past year and a half together. Because it's actually not fact-based, as you said, it's a philosophy. And it's a philosophy that's rooted in the worst of America's economic history. That particular philosophy that says that some people are worthy and other people are not, and those that are not worthy are then subject to whatever those that are wish to do with them, for them, about them, is what's rooted back in the time when the United States was a slave republic. And so with that thinking, it's what allowed for blacks to be dispossessed of their labor, Native Americans to be dispossessed of their land. As a matter of fact, Ayn Rand, who is, of course, Paul Ryan's philosophical muse, said that Native Americans should be dispossessed of their property because they hadn't created an effective capitalist society in 1,000 years.
Well, of course, the thing I love best about Ayn Rand is that ultimately in her old age, she took Social Security, which, you know, I suppose there's a story there about sort of how, you know, we have this sense that on the one hand, we don't, you know, we want to make it all on our own. We build that ourselves. And yet we do tend to avail ourselves of the help, of the assistance that exists. Matt, you wrote a little bit about this in your piece this week around economic determinism, suggesting that you should be the target audience for what Romney was saying there, this claim about makers and takers. You know, I love this. You said, I never took the federally guaranteed student loan. You never enjoyed the mortgage interest deduction, all things which I, as a taker, do. And you're worried about government spending. And yet there was still something that did not sit right about
this
set of comments.
Well, it's the determinism. It's the statement that because you fall into this income gap, that your vote, that your political beliefs are fixed, that they don't move. I mean, I just spent a week at the Republican National Convention. Every speech was about how, oh, my grandmother came over here, or grandfather, and he didn't ask for a handout and worked really hard and changed their station in life, right? The upward mobility, the American dream, and all that kind of stuff. It's not about stasis, it's about dynamism. Well, this is the absolute opposite of that. This is saying that when I lived under the poverty line, that my vote was therefore predictable. That's just not true. It's insulting. It doesn't stand up to any kind of measurement. And it obscures an actual point that people like me who want to reduce the size of government want to make, which is that it's more that it's politically difficult to cut back on things that you give to taxpayers. And this is a bipartisan issue. This is not a Republican or Democratic issue. The biggest single recipient of you know, giveaways or whatever you want to put it, of benefits from government are the elderly. It's retirees, and they're Republicans. They vote Republican by a large amount. So that is an interesting issue to talk about, going after things like the mortgage interest deduction, which lower class people don't receive because they don't buy houses. It is politically difficult, and when we're borrowing 43 cents on every dollar, that's something to talk about, but it's not a partisan issue.
Right, so is this part of the invisible state problem that, like, we see food stamps, but we don't see our mortgage interest deduction?
Well, I mean, what interests me also, though, is, I mean, not only is there cruelty and contempt in what Romney said, but there was a stupidity because, as Matt points out, he's writing off voters.
His own voters.
Yeah. There's a misunderstanding of the nature of how government works, how tax policy works. And with all the attention to, I think, the ugly social policies, the dog whistle racism, the ugly immigration policies, one thing that this tape, as you pointed out, the real Romney is extremism and defensive privilege. But, yes, we have a submerged state, submerged government. There was a lot of work done by a Professor Mettler. There are people who are receiving earned income tax credits, other benefits like that, which people are not necessarily aware come from government. Therefore, it becomes easier to launch these anti-government attacks when, in fact, partly due to bipartisan support, because we have this low security, low wage labor market, politicians decided it was easier to do these kind of submerged benefits as opposed to a more robust I think, country where you would have a stronger social safety net, as you see in the other many other Western industrialized countries.
So I'm wondering, is it bad politics? Like, even beyond the policy, so is it bad politics based on this?
This is bad politics. When Peggy Noonan is writing in the pages of the Wall Street Journal, it is not just a bad campaign, but a rolling calamity, then you know you have some problems. I mean, I think what this has done, setting aside the actual policy side of this, which is significantly questionable, given the fact that Mitt Romney's father got government handouts when he came here from Mexico, and Paul Ryan's mother also got government help. It has exposed Romney as somewhat, it furthers, if not cements, the narrative that Mitt Romney is basically wearing a top hat and carrying around big money bags, and that's the real Mitt Romney, this sort of elusive plutocrat who really only cares about, quote unquote, the takers. For him to try and reverse that momentum, and keep in mind, Melissa, he released his tax returns yesterday, which to many people was exactly the wrong time to be bringing that question back to the fore. He has some serious problems in his campaign, and now we're seeing a sort of departure from his own party. There's some real walking back of Romney support, and some real convincing has to do with the donor community.
Yeah, and so we're going to talk about exactly this issue of the taxes and also sort of the politics around this and more on the policy, because I want to take him at his word. I'm not prepared to call an election in September. So if he is president, what does this end up meaning for us? So Romney is trying to re-steer his ship, but it's possible he might be running it aground. We're going to look at those long-awaited tax returns when we get back. On Friday, Mitt Romney tried to change the conversation of his most terrible, horrible, no good, very bad, worst week ever. How? He decided to release his long-awaited tax returns. And his returns irrefutably prove that Romney is definitely part of the 53%, the half of Americans who do pay federal taxes. Mr. Romney contributed a hefty $1.9 million to public coffers in 2011 from his $13.7 million in earnings. But don't do the math just yet, because Mitt Romney doesn't want you to focus on the 14.1 effective federal tax rate that he paid. Along with copies of his tax returns, the Romney camp posted a memo from the family's lawyer about the past 20 years of his returns, stating, the total federal and state taxes owed plus the total charitable donations deducted represented 38.49% of total adjusted gross income. See, he is not keeping it all. Giving to charity and paying his tax obligations is one big Romney family Christmas gift to America. What do you think, guys? Is this the effective way to turn this conversation?
Well, first of all, I mean, I think it was days and days late, dollars short, still incomplete. But to me, Melissa, the biggest question is, the way he has done aggressive tax policy avoidance, is that how he would run his tax policy if he became president? And one thing we don't know from Mitt Romney, even though we now have seen the real Mitt Romney in many ways, is he talks about closing tax loopholes. He won't say which ones, though we do know that the one tax loophole which he won't close is the one that truly benefits the very rich, which is this 15% tax on capital gains and dividends and this private equity carried interest tax. And that is what kept his tax returns so low. If you do the summary, you notice that our tax policy has become more regressive because 10, 15 years ago, the taxes on capital gains and dividends were close to 30%. Yeah. This country's tax system is perverse. We should tax wealth more and work less.
What is the logic of releasing this 20-year summary? I mean, it is, I won't say political suicide, but now the Obama campaign can say, then why won't you just release those 20 years? Why did you give John McCain more information than you're going to give the American public? Why would you keep that alive? Why would you wait until this point? Early voting has started in swing states. Yeah. The notion that somehow this is going to lay to rest the question of Mitt Romney's tax returns is totally ludicrous. You talk about the political strategy here. There doesn't seem to be any.
Yeah, speaking of the strategy, I want to, on 60 Minutes, Romney was asked about this sort of the CEO strategic position that he's, positioned himself as. Let's listen to his response here.
You're the CEO of this campaign. A lot of Republicans would like to know, a lot of your donors would like to know, how do you turn this thing around? You've got a little more than 6 weeks. What do you do?
Well, it doesn't need a turnaround. We got a campaign which is tied with an incumbent president of the United States.
All right, so typically I dislike sort of, you know, the political commentary being about whether or not you're running a good or a bad campaign, because in a certain way, if you win, everybody thinks you ran a good campaign, and if you lose, everybody thinks you ran a bad one, even though you might have run a great one and lost, right? But this moment where he says, the reason that you should elect me is because I'm a good CEO, I'm a good decision maker, and I can turn around companies. So he's asked, how do you turn around the campaign? And his response is, well, it doesn't even need a turnaround. Like, it's as though he can't diagnose that there is, in fact, a problem here.
Well, I wonder, go ahead.
I think one of the problems is that this isn't a campaign that's only about politics or policy, which a lot of times it does seem that he divides things into these silos. It's actually about the vision for the country, and we're electing a person, which is why the 47% comments are so revelatory, because they reveal the person. And in that, the release of the tax returns, which makes no sense politically whatsoever, the 20 years, everything Alex said is totally out of bounds in terms of someone who actually wants to occupy the White House, but he doesn't think he has to. He doesn't actually think that he has to reveal the way he made his money, because all you need to know is that he's wealthy, he was a CEO, he knows what to do, he went to Harvard, his dad was a governor, I'm a good person, that's enough.
This is Katrina's point about defensiveness about privilege.
But that's actually not enough.
But you're not going to vote for him.
Picking up on a very good point you made about how we're electing a person. First of all, I hate the idea that America needs a CEO. I mean, we're not a business unless he wants to offshore and outsource this country. But we're not just electing a person. We're not just electing a person. Mitt Romney, though disliked by many in the Republican Party, is a vehicle for forces like the Koch brothers, like Shelley Adelson, for those who, let's be honest, are investing chump change in proportion to their wealth in order to affect deregulation, lower taxes, and a vision of an America that would set us back and dismantle the civilizing advances of this country economically, socially, culturally, politically. You can see I care deeply about this, but he's not just a person. He is a vehicle for those forces.
I would say he's a mirror. We had a great piece in Reason by Peter Suderman talking about his role as a consultant. I mean, he's the consultant's consultant, and by most accounts, he was very good at that job. And what you do as a consultant is you go in and you say to someone, you flatter that person in order to get their business. You hold up a nice mirror to them so that you can convince them to hand over the strategy to this guy. And that's what he's done to the Republican Party. His views have been incoherent all along.
Yes.
He avoids, as Katrina pointed out, he doesn't actually have a very specific tax plan. I don't care about his tax returns. And I think most people who are not going to vote for Barack Obama, which I'm not going to vote for Romney either, but don't really care about his tax returns, just like they didn't care about John Kerry's tax returns in 2004 when Republicans cared about that. It's kind of a partisan thing that people get excited about. They do care about what he's going to actually do policy-wise, and he is so intentionally vague on that because he doesn't want to take a stand.
Right, because they care about their tax, right? Americans care about their tax returns. What is my tax return?
They care about fairness, too.
Yes.
And they care about everybody playing by the rules, and they care about someone who's occupying 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue who thinks about what's right for the country and what's wrong for the country. And the fact is, Mitt Romney's moral compass has been spinning every which way. There is no true magnetic north. The wall of obfuscation that he has built around his campaign gives nobody a sense that they have a seat at the table that Mitt Romney is laying.
Right.
There's no sense that he wants to be the president of the United States because he has a vision for the country and really wants to lift everybody up. That's why the comments that he's going to be the president of the 100% are ludicrous.
Right,
I said that twice now.
Right.
But it makes no sense.
Because this is the key point, right, that you do, I mean, strategically, nobody campaigns for 100% of votes, right? I mean, that is a reasonable campaign strategy. Do not try to get 100% of the people to vote for you. But it was the sound about the notion that he also would somehow not govern for the 100% that felt, that was the piece.
Myself with these people.
But he does have a plan. I think that this is also not true. I mean, the Tax Policy Center has scored his tax plan. It's $9.6 trillion in cuts in 8 years. Mm-hmm. If you go to his website and you look at his fair tax plan and you add in his promise to balance the budget, that's the number. Mm-hmm. And it includes a $5 trillion tax cuts for people like him, rolling back the estate tax by 30%, eliminating eliminating the estate tax for over $5 million, on and on and on. It includes a 40% increase in the defense budget, giveaways to an industry that overwhelmingly benefits Republicans. And so he does have the tax plans, and he's tried not to be vague, but in the course of running for president over the year and a half, and the 47% reveals it.
Thing, I mean, by saying he supports cut, cap, and balance, that doesn't show you how he's going to. So if you score that, you can't score.
$2 trillion cuts to Medicare, $1.4 to Medicaid, $2 trillion to...
There's a faith-based quality to the Mitt Romney tax plan, because if you believe that he cares about deficit reduction, which we hear ad nauseum, and you look at what you just described as this tax plan, it's not about deficit reduction. It's about moving around a tax code to benefit and to harm those who fall
short. Not that you and I care much about deficit reduction per se, but
we don't.
But our goal would be
that's what they want to do, their aspiration.
Everybody stay right here. We are not going away. There's more on this, but I do. The one down ballot race at the top of the nation's political mind made more news on Thursday night when Democratic upstart Elizabeth Warren debated incumbent Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown in their first debate. After Senator Brown finished remarking about her Native American heritage and calling her professor as if it were an insult, right? Harvard Law professor Warren cited one reason why races like hers are so important.
The way I see this is that Roe versus Wade is settled law. Women should be able to count on this. This really may be a race for control of the Senate, and the Supreme Court may very well hang in the balance.
So there's a lot more at stake in November than just who will be the next president. As Republican obstructionism has shown us in the past few years, what's also at stake is how effective that president will be in doing the work of governing. Joining me now to discuss the down ballot races, the nation's Katrina VandeHeuvel, Amara Jones of Colorlines.com, MSNBC's Alex Wagner, and Reason Magazine's Matt Welch. All right, we talk a lot about the presidential races, what we talk about, but the fact is, down ballot races, as we just heard from Elizabeth Warren, this might be where the real governing is happening.
Well, I think there are three elections this year. There's the presidential, the Senate, and the House races. Yeah. And I thought Senator Warren. I'm jumping ahead. Elizabeth Warren.
Go for it.
Elizabeth Warren was very savvy, very smart in linking, yoking, tying Scott Brown to the National Republican Party, because Senator Brown has gotten a pass from Mitch, my man, and Senator DeMint in taking votes he needs to take to stay viable in Massachusetts, even though he's tried to gut Dodd-Frank, the attempt to reform Wall Street, et cetera. I think also she brought up an issue that is too often under the radar for progressives. The Nation just published something, an issue called the 1% court, which is about how the court has become a court for corporations, of corporations, by corporations, shafting ordinary people. And Elizabeth Warren's stake to the Senate should be her defense of ordinary people working, living in a rigged system for the benefit of the 1% and the Mitt Romneys.
And yet it is so hard. I mean, the situation that we currently find ourselves in is because we had the typical surge and decline. Everybody shows up for the 2008 election and then stays home for 2010. How do we get Americans to say, yes, there is this big presidential race, there's this guy that we're voting for at the top, this person, this personality, but the much bigger issues of governing may be happening at your much more local level.
Well, one of the things that I thought was good for driving that point home was when we focused on women's health and legislation targeting women's reproductive freedoms. And I'm not just talking about the choice stuff, but, you know, the transvaginal ultrasound stuff. Scott Brown was a co-sponsor of the Blunt Amendment. I mean, the fact is, they have been, that it's sort of, Todd Akin did us all a service insofar as he sort of pulled back the curtain on what's actually been happening in Congress and the kind of laws that the Republican Congress has been passing while nobody's basically been paying attention. I thought that was good as far as a wake-up call to the nation. Like, you have to pay attention to what is going on here. It's not just that the system is broken and they can't get budgets passed. There is draconian legislation going on that is being passed by one party and it isn't being made law because you can't get it past the Senate.
But
I also think that going back to the person matters, that Democrats have great candidates. I mean, they show that the people running matters. And one of the reasons why Elizabeth Warren is surging is because she reads authentic. After having an entire summer being bashed for being inauthentic, when one actually sees her, she reads grit down home, and people respond to that. And I also think that the surge of the Democrats right the way across the board shows the successful use of the convention to nationalize the Senate races and to nationalize the elections. The Democrats did a much better job of using the convention to showcase their Senate candidates, and that all got played in 1 minute, 2 minute segments at home, and it just read well. She was the warm-up act, by her own words, for Bill Clinton, for Elvis, and that showed up, and that made a difference.
I think Elvis aside, who was remarkable at the convention, the problem Democrats and progressives have is that the wind is not in their sails right now. Reality has not been their friend. Just the lived-in economic reality under Democratic governance has not been as good as Democrats themselves had promised it all along the way, and that is an actual problem. There isn't enthusiasm. If you look at where there has been tangible and sort of new political enthusiasm in the process, and I would include Scott Brown in that, you know, when he first got elected, not now as much, it has not come from people getting excited about progressive ideas. It has
Matt, there hasn't been a chance, let's be honest. The scale of our problems have not been met adequately yet. There is a jobs bill that is in the Senate that is being obstructed by Republicans. There are all kinds of measures and programs that could have been taken, whether infrastructure building or jobs.
I think we're actually seeing some evidence that says that there is some enthusiasm coming back. And I think, as you point out, I think War on Women is part of it. Obviously, the McCaskill-Aiken piece is part of that shift. But I got to say, the Virginia one is
unbelievable.
The Virginia one is just blowing my mind.
The gender gap in Virginia is staggering. Yeah. It was, I mean, Kane is leading, I believe, by 14% among women. Yep. So is Obama. And in 2008, he and McCain, I believe, tied for the women's vote. Virginia's been ground zero, as you pointed out, for the intrusive, odious assault on women's bodies. And you have an attorney general who I think is going to be a factor. Mm-hmm. He is attempting to shut down the remaining abortion clinics in Virginia through some, you know, regulations about reclassifying abortion clinics as hospitals. But it's been so transparent that we may see a baked-in, as you've put it earlier in the show, a gender gap for a generation or more to come if the Republican Party doesn't get on the
shift. I think an important thing to think about, one, in terms of abortion, is that, and settled law, another person who agrees with Elizabeth Warren about
abortion.
That.
It's not just abortion, it's contraception, it's women's health.
Yeah.
It's a whole set of issues.
Right.
And
they're happening much more on a local and state level and in very insidious ways that you point out. Yeah. But John Roberts believes that Roe versus Wade is settled law, too. I think people use, and it's understandable that they get excited about it. I'm pro-choice too, but ultimately that is, you know, it's probably not. We're not going to see Roe versus Wade.
But Ginsburg is going to go out under highly likely, right? That Ginsburg is not going to be any more part of the Supreme Court during the next presidency, right?
The ability to make three or four court appointments. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who is extraordinary, is 79 and not in good health.
Yeah, Scalia. Really under discussed in terms of what is on the table as far as you know, the forces shaping the American electorate.
And there's even more stuff on the table that is totally tripping me out. We spent some time looking at some of the stuff that was really down ballot. I can't even believe what's going on in Alabama. So up next, when you vote in November, and you are going to vote, right? In certain states, you're going to be voting on something much more important than a candidate. Seriously, come back. I want to tell you about it. Candidates aren't the only ones down the ballot from President Obama and Governor Mitt Romney this fall. You are. Yes, you. Let me explain. If you are gay and live in Maine, Maryland, Minnesota, or Washington State, your freedom to marry whomever you love and have that marriage legally recognized is on the ballot. What other things that impact Americans directly is at the deep, dark bottom of the ballot? Here again, my panel. All right. I was tripping on the things that people are voting on down the ballot. In Alabama, I'm sorry, this just kills me. In Alabama, apparently Jim Crow, in the in terms of referencing segregation in schools and also the poll tax, are still currently in the state constitution. Alabama voters are going to get an opportunity to vote on whether or not they would like Jim Crow to still be instantiated in their state's constitution. We have an Arizona land seizure sort of down the ballot. We've got capital punishment in California. Will these things drive in a way that affects the up ballot, or will the up ballot drive it in a way that then impacts those down ballot races?
I think it's a separate thing at this point. People are using the ballot initiative process, particularly in the West, to circumvent government. In fact, you know, the Alabama thing is a way of saying, I don't like what our government has done, and let's expunge that. I'm super excited about marijuana legalization, which is on the ballot, full legalization in Colorado, Washington, and Oregon. That is the beginning of the end of the drug war, just like Prohibition ended when New York went in open revolt. If it passes in Colorado, then the federal government is going to have to decide whether or not it's going to try to enforce its own laws over the expressed wishes of an entire state.
I join with Matt in support of those initiatives. Marijuana legalization, absolutely. The drug war has failed. But boy, if you think this is going to change the course of that without some additional federal transnational pressure, I'm excited. And I do think we've seen in the last three or four election cycles where the initiatives have brought out people, have energized people. I'm thinking of the minimum wage initiatives a few cycles ago. One was in Florida. But there's you talked about a really odious one. Yeah. Well, I hate to ask what the poll numbers look like in Alabama.
I know, I'm afraid.
With all due respect to the good state of Alabama. But there's some progressive initiatives. Yeah. There's one in Michigan about, it's called Protect Our Jobs, which is an attempt to restore collective bargaining. Yep. There's one in Montana, which is to try and overturn the Supreme Court's overturning of the state ban on corporate contributions.
So
these are interesting ones that I think
these could energize.
I mean, this is something that's done every election cycle, which is to say you put
initiatives on the ballot to gin up turnout. I mean, there's a strategy here. I mean, with gay marriage, with something like the Jim Crow piece in Alabama, this is an effort to get a certain part of the electorate out to the polls. Now, with, I think, divisive measures like the Jim Crow thing, you know, and we've seen with gay marriage, it does not favor the progressive side of the coin, which is to say conservative come out in force, and therefore, to your question, does this then influence up ballot? Yeah, you could see that being a good thing for Mitt Romney at the end of the day.
Although marriage equality this time looks like it may pass. Right? Yeah. I mean, the Maryland piece, that shift that occurred when the president said, didn't change policy, but said that he was in support of marriage equality. Right. Next thing you saw, Maryland shifted on this.
I mean, it shows the power of the presidency, which one of the things, it seems that the president has clued into by his own admission late into the power of the bully pulpit, but it shows that presidential words matter, that they do have the ability to influence policy, and that that's an important thing to not forget, and that it will turn, given, you know, the controversy there over football and all the rest of it. I might start watching. The other thing, though, on going back to the Alabama conversation, I mean, the Alabama Constitution is a relic of history anyway, so Jim Crow should stay in it just for historical reference, because it was the model for the apartheid constitution in South Africa in 1948. They're doing history a favor. But one thing that's also important to think about the way that these ballot initiatives are used, there was a study done by progressives in California, and every off-year election, the electorate is totally different. That is to say that the people who show up in off-years aren't the same people that show up in other years. Yeah. And so I think that we have to be careful about using and manipulating the down-ballot process in off-years and in general to legislate, because we are manipulating the electorate.
Yeah, and you have to feel only in Nerdland you get a progressive making an argument to keep Jim Crow in a state constitution just for the value of history. Alex, thank you so much. For
it's
being here. Right, living history.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. The combination of Mitt Romney's 47% comment earlier this week and Paul Ryan's proposed plans for Medicare might have a particular group of American voters raging right now. Not only is the Republican ticket in danger of alienating the poor, but also seniors. Let me tell you, when you mess with grandma and grandpa, you better get prepared. Just look at the reception that Paul Ryan got yesterday in New Orleans at an AARP event when he talked about Medicare.
The first step to a stronger Medicare is to repeal Obamacare, because it represents the worst of both worlds. I had a feeling there would be mixed reaction, so let me get into it.
To the extent that poverty has made it into our national conversation, it's been mostly about poor children, which is reasonable. But that's because the signing of the Social Security Act in 1935 and the passage of Medicare in 1965, many thought that we'd solve the problem of poor old people. And why shouldn't they? Those laws were part of a bipartisan government success that included a broad commitment to our greatest generation. But now, that commitment is back on the table, and it's been replaced by plans for seniors of today and tomorrow to get over themselves and stop looking for entitlements. But with 36 million retired workers receiving Social Security benefits, 49.4 million Medicare beneficiaries, and the reality of seniors quietly letting go of their entitlements without a fight, it's pretty unlikely. And the way seniors may fight back come November is with their vote at the table. Katrina Vanderheuvel of The Nation, Matt Welch of Reason Magazine, Brenda Gardner, an actress and volunteer at AARP's Legislative Patrol, and Eddie Augusto, a retired postal worker. So nice to have you all here. I want to ask you, you actually talk with other seniors in part in your role as an AARP volunteer. What are you hearing right now?
I'm hearing a lot of things. We have these You've Earned a Say sessions where we go to different members of AARP and ask them what they're thinking. We're trying to bring these particular issues, Social Security and Medicare, out into the open, not just being discussed in Washington behind closed doors where we don't know what's going on and they're making the decisions without our input. I think of it, you're saying in 1935, I think of it as a contract with America. The government contracted that we would pay 6.2% now, I'm not sure what it was back then, of our into taxes for the Social Security fund so that when we retired, we would have income. It was a contract, and we agreed with that. And if they're going to change the contract, they have to listen to both sides, as far as I'm concerned.
And so, this, you know, it's interesting. I want to come to you on this, Eddie. When we look at the polling, there's an odd sort of mismatch between, on the one hand, the fact that Governor Romney is polling ahead with seniors overall. He's got sort of a 49% to 41% over President Obama. But look at this poll, which is from before the 47% comments. On this poll, when asked who is better on issues affecting seniors, this contract, as you were just talking about, President Obama has a big lead over Mitt Romney, so that we have seniors saying that President Obama is better on specific issues. How do you think this ends up getting reconciled at the polls for folks?
I feel, as I speak to seniors, that they have more trust in President Obama. And at a time in their life when it's actually crucial that they get their benefits and that they have a say on how it's going to be used, and the ones that kind of are interested in Romney is those people. Some of them are not really into it, and I'll be honest with you. You speak to them, and they're neither here nor there because of the facts that they know or don't know. But I think as time goes on, especially now after the boo session, it's going to wake them up.
They don't trust politicians. This I'm getting all the time. They don't trust anybody because of they're not taking care of business. It's one of my questions. Okay, we're using our vote to elect people. In these discussions, a funny kind of thing happened with one of the gentlemen who, on last Monday, he went a little off subject and was saying about the budget, which we're not, Social Security and Medicare are not about fixing the budget. They are separate. We have a trust fund that will last until 20 years at 100% to pay benefits, and after that it's 75%. We're trying to fix something ahead of time. It takes time for things to go through Congress.
Brenda's so right, I mean, in the sense that when you said something so important earlier about how it's a contract, but it's all, Social Security is too often discussed as an entitlement.
Yes.
It's an earned right. And I think one of the great things Roosevelt did was not simply lift this country out of the greatest depression, but provide for economic security, especially for seniors. I fear that there is a bipartisan kind of establishment austerity class in Washington as we head toward a possible fiscal cliff, and there's all this talk about Simpson bowls, which will really damage seniors and others who've already borne the brunt of a bacchanalia and a disaster caused by Wall Street, which has not had to pay for that. So
yeah, it's interesting to hear you say this, in part because Ryan, I mean, the boo session moment, he's like, oh, I expect that. What Ryan has claimed is he is being brave by touching this thing that I think he would say there's been bipartisan agreement that we're never going to fix it, we're never going to touch it, in part because the AARP stands there as this powerful source that can mobilize voters and say, no, you will not touch this.
Ryan had been brave before he became nominated to the vice president. Yeah. It's important. I mean, I think Democrats have been conflating Paul Ryan, the pre-vice president, with Paul Ryan, the vice presidential nominee. That's not what Mitt Romney, the actual nominee, has been campaigning on. He campaigns every single day against Barack Obama's Medicare cuts. Yeah. Every day. There isn't a day that he doesn't make that point. He campaigned against Rick Perry talking about Social Security as a Ponzi scheme. He says we need to guarantee our contract with seniors. Mitt Romney is not campaigning on anything like cutting entitlements. And the shame
but
of
Paul
that.
Ryan, but it's
six words. When people describe Paul Ryan as brave or courageous, it makes me think about how we've really degraded the term political courage in our system. It does not take political courage to take a whack at the most vulnerable in this country and society who've already borne the brunt of the economic crisis.
Seniors are not the most vulnerable. This is a misnomer. Seniors make you might be most vulnerable. My mom might be the most vulnerable. But as a class, seniors have 47 times.
Just like everybody else, we have similar problems. Just from birth to death, everybody has similar problems. Overall, we're interested in a good quality of life. What that good quality of life is depends on the individual. But basics are roof over your head, food and clothing, and the ability to survive with those basics, and health, and I like to add in activity every day that gives you joy. That's just part of
the pursuit of happiness. We're going to talk. I promise we're going to stay on exactly that, because I think what you just articulated, that was in part what we heard in those 47% comments. How dare you think of yourself as entitled to food and housing and joy?
I never did finish my comment. And when, about a gentleman, which I want to tell you.
And when we come back, we're going to let you finish all that. I promise. We've been talking about how seniors are reacting to the Republican ticket's take on Social Security, Medicare, and Mitt Romney's 47% comment, the latter of which the Obama campaign seized upon in a new web ad yesterday. Take a look.
It frightens me that someone could think that way and is running for president.
These people that he's talking about paid income tax many years, and they worked to get to where they are today to be able to have maybe a little free time. And a lot of them are still working part-time with their Social Security and still aren't making enough to pay.
It offends me. It puts me in that group. We have paid into Social Security all our working life, and we therefore are getting what we have invested in. It's not like we're getting money from the government.
Brenda, this is the point you just made about this being a contract.
That everybody agreed on. Before we started talking, there was a gentleman at one of these user earned a say session that got off subject of Social Security and Medicare, talking about the budget. And what about his idea was to barter? What about a barter system? Which I said, that's a little off subject. But I kind of love the idea, like the barter theater in Abingdon, Virginia, when it started, and also in the 30s, you could bring a chicken or produce and get a ticket to the theater. And the image of our congressman being paid with chickens and vegetables really makes me smile.
Yeah, well, that's the thing that brought you joy for the day. Absolutely. So, Eddie, when I introduced you earlier, I was talking about the fact that your retirement is from the U.S. Postal Service. And I'm thinking that, in certain ways, it represents an entire economic shift for us as a country. Certainly, we're talking about Social Security, Medicare policies, but also, how are seniors at this moment thinking about the economy, not just for themselves, but for the young folks who are coming behind them who can't work these kinds of jobs anymore because they just don't even exist anymore?
Well, it's not only the jobs that don't exist, it's the rules that you're going to come into the system. Mm-hmm. And it's totally drastic compared to when I started. I did 43 years, and by the time I retired, I was ready to retire. I was financially set. Then the recession came, and I suffered. I suffered. Not that I'm broke, but I don't have a Swiss bank account.
Well, and that's not a small thing. I mean, the number of folks I run into who are in their late 60s, early 70s, who are working small, you know, sort of small jobs. You know, I'll get in a cab, and I've got a 67-year-old cab driver who is retired from a government job, maybe, but just doesn't feel like he has enough to, you know, to live or to survive, or folks who are working as baggers and cashiers. Like, is there a story about the economic side of this that you want to hear from the candidates?
I believe that Obama is on the right track. He still has things to do. But Romney is just too disengaged. It's an element of fear. He projects an element of fear. And when you're a senior, you've reached this stage in your life, and you worry about your medicine, worried about your food, worry about all kinds of benefits. And that fear, when you see Romney up there, he represents that fear, that certain unknown that comes out. And I think that's what's keeping him from connecting with people. And at that stage in your life, even now, 50 plus, doesn't sound old. It isn't old.
It's not. But it's empirically not.
50 plus becomes 60 plus very quickly.
But did you see that story? And it was in the paper yesterday about mortality rates for women. And it's quite stunning in this very rich country that, first of all, we don't really have much upward social mobility anymore, which was part of the American dream, but that women, particularly, I believe, single women with high school education, are now dying at much younger rates because maybe health disparities and maybe other factors. But it seems to me that economic security is something that binds seniors, a younger generation, which is growing up in this environment where joblessness is the new normal. And I think that scars a generation, it scars a country, it scars the possibility of democracy in many ways, or the sense of a contract. So it's a very new period, but the danger, I hope, is that, well, I hope that we don't allow this joblessness and the insecurity for seniors to be a new normal. That should not be the new normal.
Let's talk about something that Bill Clinton brought up in his speech in the Democratic Convention, which was math. This is the problem with our concept of a contract for Medicare. The math of Medicare, according to the Urban Institute study from last year, if you retired at 65 in 2010, more or less, you put in, through payroll taxes, about $58,000 into the Medicare trust fund, and you will receive about $185,000 coming out. That number is growing and will grow only further as the baby boom generation retires. That is a math problem, and it's a big one, and trying to say that it doesn't exist is a problem that we
have. But it's a math problem that's solvable if you have young people who are a larger population, who are working, who are paying in, right? Because it's not actually a savings account. It's not actually your money, right? It is today's workers paying in so that our parents and our grandparents can have moments of joy, can have some relaxation.
But look in Social Security, which is a hell of a lot more solvent than Medicare is. In 1940, there were 149 of those workers for every one recipient. Now there's 3 to 1. That's going down. The share of Social Security and Medicare as federal spending right now is 37%. It's going to be 50% by 2030. If we don't address that math, the math will eat us whole.
First of all, what I loved about Clinton was arithmetic. All I would say is there's sometimes hysteria about Social Security going bankrupt. There is a manageable shortfall with which some smart changes and reforms, Social Security remains solved.
I'm talking about here.
Right, and I appreciate everyone being at the table. First, we've got to take a quick preview of Weekends with Alex Witt.